Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Decouple Podcast, where we explore the science and technologies that can decouple human well-being from its ecological impacts, and the politics that can make decoupling possible.
Welcome back to Decouple. I'm Dylan Moon. We have a bit of an interesting format this episode. We were gone last week on a road trip, a crash tour of some nuclear facilities up in Ontario. We visited NWMO's packaging facility in Oakville, went on to BWXT in Cambridge, a major nuclear supplier, toured Bruce Station B, went to OPG's Nuclear Sustainability Services Western facility there, where they store a lot of the spent fuel or nuclear byproduct for Ontario, then finished out with a visit to the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's South Bruce facility, where they are taking samples of the large chunk of rock that they want to put the deep geological repository in as a long-term solution for high-level nuclear waste. We recorded this brief reflection in the car on the way back from our first visit to the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's packaging facility in Oakville. We talk about what we were impressed by, as well as some lingering comments we have about NWMO's extensive siting and engineering process for a deep geological repository.
Welcome back to Decouple. I'm here with Dylan Moon. Dylan, how you doing?
I'm good.
His mouth is full of Tim Hortons.
Not the best time to start recording, but...
Dylan is up from Hoboken, New Jersey, visiting for a pretty cool road trip we put together, touring Canada's nuclear sites, I guess. We're looking at the back end today. I had a visit at the Nuclear Waste Management Organization's above ground, a modeling facility?
Yeah, mock-up of what's going to be 500 meters underground, hopefully in South Bruce or...
Yeah, I mean, and so they've got examples of, their canisters, their steel and copper canisters. They've got bentonite clay stuff, which is what goes on the outside of that. What else they got?
All in an extremely nondescript facility. with a removable sign out front to, hide from protesters, or
I think it's less hiding from protesters, but like if they had big signage out front saying, Nuclear Waste Management Organization, I think the locals would probably assume that they were storing something gnarly on site. So I'm pretty charitable with that. I don't think they'd have, yeah. Well, then probably protests would happen, you're right, but yeah, it is the removable sign is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, but yeah, so what do they have inside? Kind of just ran down, they've got a ton of bags of bentonite clay, which is just powdered clay that they've ordered from Wyoming.
And the coolest thing is they have this mock-up of the tunnel, which would be, they'd have 3 kilometers by 2 kilometers of area, and then that's just like feathered the right word? Anyway, tunnels, side tunnels, which they would jam-pack full of these copper canisters containing Canada's nuclear waste, of which we have almost 3 million bundles. And again, these Canadian waste or the spent fuel bundles, not like the pressurized and boiling water designs where they're like 14 feet long, kind of rectangular assemblies.
They're very small.
We say they look like a little log of wood, right?
You can hold them. Yeah. They're almost bite-sized, you might even say.
Dylan's, of course, referencing one Canadian politician who seemed to misunderstand me, to put it charitably, recommending. And again, I did not recommend, but he thought I recommended eating it. Anyway, it is not bite-sized, but probably about the size of a log, that Canadians would split and put in our wood stoves if you live up north.
Let's run down what the actual artificial barriers are that are in place. Right, sure. So you've got the small fuel bundle. You pack a lot of them end to end and side by side into a meticulously crafted steel capsule coated with copper, which is extremely corrosion resistant. And you place that inside 2 halves of this pressed bentonite clay
box. It looks like a coffin, kind of, except the walls would be really thick, and it's the impression of the copper can.
Resting place of this nuclear spent byproduct.
Yes, byproduct. We're not calling it waste. We're not calling it spent fuel. It is now a byproduct of the wonderful process, the life-giving process to the grid of fission.
Yeah, so then you basically have this bentonite clay box. And the reason bentonite's so good is because it's just got these amazing water-resistant properties. If water gets to it, it swells up to like 10 times. It can completely block water from getting through to the fuel. I mean, they use it at every single decommissioned well in Canada. You like dump bentonite clay down there, and
yeah, it acts as a plug, I guess. Yeah, and I mean the package, like the bentonite clay with the copper canister with the fuel inside it, weighs, was it 4,000-5,000 pounds per package? Yeah. And I forget how many fuel assemblies of these little, you know, again, it looks like logs you'd cut up and use for firewood. I think there's like 40 or 50 inside each package or something.
I can't recall exactly, but it's extremely robust. And we're just talking about the artificial barriers.
Right.
Right. Like, they did all the geological surveying to find the perfect rock 500 meters down to put it in, which is this extremely uniform, sort of impermeable rock.
Yeah, it's a limestone called the Cobourg Formation, and yeah, the fluid conductance, meaning how quickly water can percolate through this rock, is about 1 in a million years, and that's aside from all of these engineered barriers. So, you know, it's pretty robust, and for someone as nuke-pilled as myself or Dylan, I mean, it was, I think today was as interesting from a like engineering and technical perspective as it was from a sort of cultural anthropology perspective. And for me, at least, I really got this sense of which, you know, the as low as reasonably achievable and quote unquote gold standard culture is applied to nuclear waste management. And that would be, again, both from an engineering perspective, but I think almost more interesting today was from the perspective of permitting, of social license, of ultimately approval of this project.
Yeah, their consent-based siting project that's going on for 20 years now, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way to put this is that, like, if we had infinite amount of time, infinite amount of money and resources, and no real urgency to get anything built ever, this would be the gold standard. This would be amazing. Every project should go through this process, you know, of 20 years of community consent and education. And I think, I mean, they do a really magnificent job of presenting information, of developing, you know, absolute world-class expertise and understanding, you know, the all of the technical elements, the chemistry, the physics of this whole operation. But again, particularly in terms of how they interact with communities. I mean, if you were to apply this kind of a process to any other mega project or infrastructure project or resource extraction project in the country, I think you'd have a really hard time getting anything built or done.
I mean, there is no doubt that they have been engaging with local communities every single step of the way and relying on their voluntary participation and informed consent. Everything from, you know, the communities having to be the ones to raise their hand if they're interested, and then going through many, many iterations where they can drop out if they feel like it, making sure there's like knowledge transfer and education. But in the end, there's going to be this $20+ billion project that comes down to whether the town says yes or no, we want it.
Yeah, and the decision is sounding like it's, you know, they have apparently the municipalities and the First Nations affected, or in whose territory the project may or may not be sited. They decide how this should happen in terms of, like, should there be a referendum? Should this be a vote at municipal council? What it should look like? And, you know, for the most likely site, or I think the most favorable site, which is in South Bruce, which has, again, probably the best rock in the world for this project, it looks like it's going to boil down to a municipal referendum as well as a referendum for the First Nation on whose traditional territory this project could be sited.
Do you remember what they said if it's a no for the referendum?
Yeah, if it's a no, it's a no. There is absolute veto from either this municipal referendum or from this First Nation. And what's interesting is there was a near-surface geologic, I think it was still pretty deep, but there was a, no, actually it was deep. I remember seeing the diagram for it. It was still about 500 meters deep. It was for intermediate and low level waste. And it was actually on the Bruce Power site. Again, that's the site of the world's largest operating nuclear facility. So very conveniently located, amazing geology. And it's interesting. I mean, there was a whole process. This, you know, the nuclear waste in Canada is managed. It's a federal responsibility, federal regulations. And moving from a conservative government that seemed to be sort of shepherding along, they lost the election, and this whole regulatory environment was reviewed by the new Liberal minister. And this idea of free, prior, and informed consent, as well as veto power, worked its way into the decision making. And ultimately, that project was nixed by the local First Nation voting pretty overwhelmingly, 80% to 20% against. Allowing this project to go ahead.
Though they only had a little over 1,000 votes in a community of several thousand, so it's not like it was a sample of it was a small sample of the possible voters actually voting on this.
But that's just the thing that's interesting to me is, you know, having been a little bit involved in electoral politics, you know, getting the vote out on election day, driving little old ladies from the political party that I was helping out to the polling station. I mean, so much of winning an election is your ground game, right? I mean, it's obviously comms and, there's obviously novel ways to reach out to voters and get them fired up. Obviously, as we've seen in the U.S. And in Canada as well, if there's a culture wars issue that can be pressed, you can mobilize a base. But again, so much of it is just the ground game. And what makes me very worried about a referendum here is that, anti-nuclear activists have gotten years and years and years in the game. Their ground game is good. You know, they're used to knocking on doors, handing out pamphlets. And I think ultimately they'd have a much better ground game than people who favor the DGR. And in the end, it is a backyard project. It does look like it'll bring, I think they said sort of peak will be 500 jobs and over a kind of 120 year period, I think an average of, 300-400 jobs to the community. It's going to bring a lot of economic benefit, but nuclear waste makes people nervous. And I can't see diehards being like, I'm going to go vote, for this DGR. Like, it's hard to imagine people being super motivated and beyond just voting themselves, being like, I'm going to go drive my neighbors to the poll. Again, this may be a mute point. Maybe it's going to be a mail-in ballot or something, but
it is an interesting dilemma.
I mean,
the other part is they were saying today, we have to be completely open and honest about the risks, no matter how small. They're modeling these things, and it's like, it would literally take a simultaneous failure of every engineered barrier, and then the most unlikely geological events all happening at the same time, like, and then somebody living on the surface off of, cows that were raised and grazed on that land, drinking their whole life out of a well pointed directly at the facility to even get like a background extra dose, right? And so you say, this can happen, and then you expect them to make a decision. And you're getting to a point where if your goal is safety, are you doing yourself a disservice? Are you, by telling them this info that they're probably not going to judge completely rationally, when increasing the odds that they say, no, we don't want it here, thereby canceling a project that is a safer solution to begin with? You know what I mean?
Well, and in terms of that safety case, I mean, they're over-engineering it for that, absolute worst case, almost in impossibly improbable event. To still be, I wouldn't say orders of magnitude, but well below any kind of regulatory limit, right? And that it amounts to banana doses of radiation. We're talking, in the study on the Finnish Deep Geologic Repository, an extra 2 bananas worth of radiation per year if all the artificial barriers fail, there's a geologic event, and again, people live on the most contaminated site, drink only water from there, eat only food from there. So it's this,
I guess what I'm trying to say is, saying that those are possibilities, is that actually more honest? Because that people are not going to interpret that with the appropriate level of like knowing how unlikely it is.
Right.
So you're exaggerating in people's minds the likelihood of this failure happening. And so when they're going to make a decision, they're not actually thinking about the risks as real as if you had like maybe left out that one in a billion.
Well, yeah. And speaking of the kind of social anthropology of this, you know, when we brought this up, the example is given of Fukushima, right? Where the break wall wasn't quite high enough and the diesel generators flooded and the roads were all broken. So you couldn't get an auxiliary power and new generators. And I mean, say what you will about the degree of regulation, overregulation of the nuclear industry. You know, there were meltdowns at Fukushima. It has resulted in a costly cleanup. As far as we can tell, there's not been a single death associated with the radiation. One person was compensated for lung cancer. They were also a smoker. Who knows, right? We'll charitably say one person has died as a result of radiation at Fukushima. This stored nuclear waste is not anything like the hazard of a gigawatt boiling water reactor that could suffer a loss of coolant accident. I mean, this stuff is... It's out of the reactor. It's been in a pool for 10 years. Maybe it's been stored in a dry cask for another 20 years. There is no fission going on here. There's nothing that requires active cooling. Like so the level of engineering and that needs to go into making this a lower risk situation is probably very minimal, especially if we were to compare it to any other industry in terms of how they handle their waste.
And what was he saying? Iodine-129 has like a half-life of a million something years, and people talk about these like millions and thousands of years timelines. You're saying like after a couple hundred you can hold it in your hands?
Yeah, I mean, they were a bit imprecise about dose, but basically, yeah, I mean, from what I understand, most of the actinides, the stuff that's broken apart and is highly radioactive and gives off gamma rays, that's gone, certainly within 1,000 years. And you're left with just alpha and beta radiation, which means you can hold stuff with gloves on.
Can I jump back to the Fukushima thing for a second? So I'm pretty sure that I hear some people say like, well, they use Fukushima as an example of something happening that you never could have seen coming. They didn't build the seawall that tall. Anything can happen, right? Like, but actually, it was somewhat of a scandal for KEPCO not to build the seawall higher.
It had been recommended to them by the regulator, yeah.
Like, that was an example of actually cutting some corners. And yeah, it wasn't likely that that tsunami was going to happen, but it was not out of the realm of possibility, even to the point where it wasn't out of the realm of what people were recommending they do. Right. In this case, NWMO is going so far above and beyond any already stringent regulation. They are not cutting corners.
No, I mean, if anything, I don't know what kind of shape this would be, how many corners you can get on a geometric shape.
I mean,
but
if you look at those little capsules they have, they don't have any corners.
There's no corner to cut. They're very cylindrical and then hemispherical at the top and bottom.
No,
absolutely. I mean, just to give you an example of the lengths they go to model potential danger, apparently AECL, Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, which was the Crown Corporation that used to manage these concerns, 20, 30 years ago, actually modeled a meteor strike of a deep geologic repository. And apparently the impact of the meteor strike, to be sufficient to disperse this nuclear material in a way that could be in any way dangerous would wipe out
life on Earth.
So we've got bigger problems. But that's what I find so fascinating, and I would really love to see a TV episode, a reality TV show, where you take anti-nuclear people and they go and like share a household or go on vacation together and are forced to hang out with each other for a week or two, and just kind of see that these nuclear people are not bogeymen. They don't cut fucking corners. I mean, if like again, just the culture is just so over the top.
The culture is unbelievable. I mean, we're going in there saying like, isn't this a little bit excessive? I've heard, obviously they will say, it is safety to the point where nothing like would ever happen. But no, I don't think it's excessive. You ask anybody, they say no. I was asking down in my nuclear plant in New Jersey, one of the emergency management people there, I said, how many times have you even had to trigger the lowest like the lowest level emergency response. They have people living that have to live within a certain, you know, 5 minutes of the plant or something, be on call 24/7. In the lifetime of the plant, how many times have you activated even the lowest level emergency? And he's like, never.
Yeah.
I'm like, is it overkill? No.
Yeah.
And that's a consistent answer. The safety culture runs so deep.
And like, despite, you know, in being an outsider and feeling an incredible urgency to get more nuclear built so that we can decarbonize, so that we can revitalize our industrial economy, so that we can have a just transition.
Get economic prosperity.
You know my lines, Dylan. I do have this kind of like, you know, almost under the spell of a culture when you visit, right? It was really, truly like traveling to a strange and foreign land and you know, being immersed in that culture. And there is this like grudging respect I have for this culture of extreme excellence, extreme nerdiness.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways, there's a parallel. Like I talk often about the, you know, just the engineer's fetish of finding and solving problems. Like it is a dopamine rush. And there's some parallels here between the, what I'll call the kind of renewophiles, love of the Rube Goldberg machine required in order to engineer a functional grid of a weather dependent grid. And there, you know, it does share some commonalities.
You get down in the weeds and it's so fascinating. I mean, sitting there today at the beginning, we're like, okay, step back. Like this is clearly an excessive amount of engineering relative to the risk. And then 4 hours later, we're sitting at presentations where they're like modeling and like quality testing the weld on the capsule from like 20 different ways. We're like, good thing they're checking that weld in all these ways. But I got, you know, you drink the Kool-Aid a little bit at the end and you're like, but what if that weld fails?
And yeah, and like, what if that weld fails? So let's just get through that. So if that weld fails, we still have a solid ceramic fuel pellet.
Like wanting to solve that problem.
We have a solid ceramic fuel pellet in an environment with no oxygen. And apparently oxygen is pretty key for that pellet to dissolve. That was really interesting as well.
That's not the first thing. Even if that weld fails on the capsule, remember, you still have 99.99% of like this copper casing with this like almost microscopic joint that they fit together. Like,
okay, so
you still have a probably completely intact.
Okay. And this, we're getting
the bentonite.
Right.
Bed.
And we are going to be doing, an interview with a safety analyst, to talk through some of these, catastrophic failure pathways, but let's just, you know, war game this out. So you have a tiny fail on this weld. Water needs to get through the rock. It has to get through the limestone. Takes a million years to move a meter, right? It then needs to get through the bentonite, which is
literally designed not to
not to allow water to move. It's designed
it's
to
like
swell.
A miraculous substance that they use for all these sorts of water blocking.
I mean, that's why they bring it in from Wyoming of all places. Okay, it's got to get through there. Then the water has to find its way through that tiny defect in the weld
and corrode, like literally non-corrodible copper.
Right, move through steel. I think it's about an inch of steel, and then also then breach the zirconium alloy, which is what surrounds the individual ceramic fuel pellets. Dissolve the mostly uranium oxide fuel pellets in an environment with no oxygen.
You can do this experiment at home. Just get a coffee mug, put it in a cup of water, and wait until it dissolves.
Except put it 500 meters underground where there's no oxygen. And this was kind of cool. Like, just again, like, I have such enormous admiration and respect for the level of IQ and education in that room. But there's no oxygen down there. Oxygen is a surface phenomenon, and it's thanks to fucking plants, right? It's like cyanobacteria, which started the Great Oxygenation Event.
Yeah.
It was really interesting hearing about sort of the planet's sources of energetic reactions going back through time, from sulfur to like...
Okay, but yeah, we've gotten to the point where, against all odds,
right,
the underdog, the water, it made it. It made it all the way. Now it's carrying a little speck of this...
This radioisotope. That it dissolved in an anoxic environment where things don't dissolve.
It was right race against the clock. It had to do this in the first 400 years or it was no chance of contaminating.
So then the water's got to do a U-turn and find its way back out through that tiny little defect in the weld, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, again, we'll just, you know, walk back through those barriers. You got to move through the steel, the copper, back out through the bentonite. And then it's going to hit the rock wall, which only allows water to move a meter in a million years.
Yeah.
And then that water's got to traverse, you know, up about, you know, 500 meters to the surface. Or let's be charitable. Let's say there's a water table, you know, 200 meters above. It's, you know, 200 million years later, it's going to hit that water table. Now, the really interesting thing about radionuclides moving through bentonite in particular is that bentonite binds and takes things out of solution avidly.
Yeah.
And so those things bind to them. And so how much actually gets,
it might have to, in another way, heat up the bentonite so it turns into just regular clay.
Illite, apparently.
Yeah, that no longer binds water. That's one, yeah. Don't let the water know that, because that it might use that strategy.
So in any case, I mean, I think it is really, and I'm surprised that their communications don't go through this. Like, I'd love to see an animation of this. You know, if this, then that.
Yeah, not to mention, like, you could just take one of these fuel bundles and, like, drop it in a body of water and no one would even notice. Like, I'm not recommending anybody does that, but.
I mean, that's the Brett Kugelmass thing, is he's just throw it in a landfill, scoop some dirt on top. And I'm not sure I'm right there with Kugelmass just yet, but I mean, there's got to be, I wouldn't call it a happy medium, but, you know, one of the questions I asked was, you know, so this is going to cost $26 billion. Like, what kind of corners would you have to cut to do it for $2 billion and then send every high school student in Canada to university for, you know, the next generation? I mean, again, I don't know how far 20...
Remind us that money is making jobs, it's paying people.
Yeah, it is. And it's...
NWMO.
Yeah. The annual budget NWMO is around 100 million now. I mean, and this is something, like, when people talk about how nuclear is not economically viable, the fact that this industry can withstand these kind of regulatory pressures and this insane culture, and can spend 100 million a year working towards, you know, a 20 plus year process of maybe siting in this deep geologic repository, which I hate to say it, but in all likelihood will be rejected.
You don't know that.
Either by the municipality. No, I'm gonna allow myself to make a prediction that it will be vetoed either by the municipality or more likely by the First Nation.
And this is fun.
And then we start all over again. And this is all being paid for by apparently this economically unviable nuclear industry.
Yeah.
What other industry could tolerate an outlay like that in this kind of exercise of in futility, in my mind?
Am I supposed to give an example? Because I can't.
Go. No, I mean, we had some other examples. Like, what's some other, like, nasty shit that we put underground? We talked a little bit about mercury
about
injection.
Batteries.
That's a bit different. But in terms of storing other things underground.
We don't store that, but.
No, but we inject mercury into sedimentary formations under high pressure where they kind of sit without any containment. Mercury is a forever poison. I there's obviously, you know, we have the giant mine.
There's just nothing like it.
There's nothing like it in terms of the way things are regulated. And again, you know, I think we're just about to finish our little session here, but I think I had a good line at the beginning, which was, you know, if there were absolutely no time resource constraints and there was no urgency to ever build anything of any importance, I would say that this is, again, the gold standard for engineering, for community consent. It is a marvel and a wonder to go to this strange island and spend some time in this with this bizarre culture. And as we leave the island and return into our own little microculture sphere, I feel like I'm kind of coming back to my senses a little bit. Deeply appreciative of the tour and the experience, but I continue to remain very, very puzzled and really in awe of how strange this world is, this nuclear industry.
Indeed.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, like, and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, guys.